Moderator for this session. What I'm going to do is I'll tell you a little bit about myself and then ask the panelists to tell a little bit about themselves. And then we'll go into some topics and questions. And if you have a question, just raise your hand since there's a small group and we'll direct it to whoever you want to and we'll go from there. As I said, my name is Phil Hardwick. And here comes John.
This is the journalist.
Yes, it is.
I just came from another one. So.
Yes, you guys are panel to panel.
I missed my slot. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. I wrote a business column for over 30 years for the Mississippi Business Journal, and wrote a lot of other articles as well. I did other things and did that on the side. Okay. I also wrote 10 books in a little series called the Mississippi Mysteries series, and retired 5 years ago and moved to Georgia. And people say, why did you move from Mississippi to Georgia? And I say, four grandkids. So we're living in Georgia now, but I'm still identified so much with Mississippi, and I still get, you know, asked to write a lot of stuff about that. So, my wife and I, since we retired, we've been on several cruises. So the novel I'm working on now is a murder mystery on a cruise ship. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it. So what I'd like to do is to ask each of our panelists, if we'd start on the end with David, who uses another name. Tell us a little bit about yourself, David, and what you're working on right now, and then we'll just come down the line to John.
So my name is David Ryan. That's my pen name. My real name is Alan Schmadtke. For most of my career, I was a sports journalist and sports editor. Later in my career, I was a digital editor, criminal news editor, criminal justice editor, and I write mystery and suspense novels. But was happy to work. I worked at the Orlando Sentinel for most of my career. Retired from journalism in 2011, and then went into digital marketing. And now I own a content business, and that supports my book writing. So.
Good. Thanks. Next,
I'm Paul Siner. I'm a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. And if you know anything about the military, particularly the Army. I was an infantry officer, and the Army expects you to be able to do anything and everything at a moment's notice. And I got transferred to Hawaii after spending some time at the Pentagon, and when I got to Hawaii, they didn't have a slot for me, and they said, well, you've done some writing, so we'll make you a public affairs officer, and you can be in charge of the newspaper. Yeah. And I know nothing about birthing a newspaper, but I had to do it, and I started writing a column for the newspaper, and I couldn't use my name because I was in charge of it, so I had to write it under an assumed name. So I wrote a humorous column for a year for a large newspaper in Honolulu called Hawaii Army Times under the name of Henry Rhodes. So that's my journalism story.
Thank you.
Stick it in.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Rother, New York Times bestselling author of 16 books. This is my 16th book that's coming out in January. It's a thriller. I was a working journalist for 19 years, and I would write fiction on Sundays. I could not get my very first novel published. It took me 17 years. So I finally switched over to true crime because I was a newspaper reporter, and I figured, why am I trying so hard to get a novel published? I guess I should just stick with nonfiction since that's what I do for a living. And I got published. So I wrote a dozen true crime books and memoir. I got hired to write some books, which helps pay for the other books that I would write for myself, traditionally published. But in order to earn a living, I was realizing that you had to co-author books, at least for a time I did that. And it was always a challenge to work with somebody else to write their story or for them to use your name or what have you. Anyway, long story short, I kind of burned out on true crime because it's so dark and it does have a cumulative effect. So I was waiting for this book, which came out in June, to come out. It was delayed 3 times, and I was so upset and frustrated and depressed that I wrote 2.5 novels while I was waiting, including this one. And so now I've got 4 thrillers that I've written. 2 of them are under contract. I just submitted number 3 with a synopsis for number 4. And I'm hoping to keep the series, to keep that going. And this book has 2 characters. One is a surfing homicide detective, and the other is a female investigative reporter. I went to a VoucherCon 1 year, and I heard Michael Connelly say that it was really kind of impossible to have a journalist as a main character because you couldn't really get them to do what a novel character really needed to do because there were so many ethical problems. And so I used that as part of my character. So my character is very ethical, and so that's part of the plot. It's part of the conflict with the detective because he wants to date, and she says there's a line, you can't date your sources. So I've managed to bring all of my experience as a reporter and as an author of true crime, and I'm now using it in thrillers.
Great.
Aaliyah?
Good morning. My name is Aaliyah Wright, and I'm the author of Now You Owe Me, which is a thriller about twin serial killers stalking college co-eds in central Pennsylvania. Until
I don't
one
know
night.
If you can hear you back there.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
Until one night they snatched the wrong one. I have always been a journalist. I have a degree in journalism from Temple University in Philadelphia, which is where I'm from. I began writing for my high school newspaper when I was in high school, and then by the time I was 18, I was working for both the Philadelphia Daily News and the Inquirer as an editorial assistant. Left and worked with some small newspapers in the South, and eventually moved back to Pennsylvania, where I worked for another small newspaper in the Capitol, covering politics. Left that to work at the Associated Press in Philadelphia, where I covered everything as a roving reporter across the state. And then I left that to work at USA Today headquarters, where I worked for a Gannett News Service and at USA Today as the entertainment editor at GNS. I left that, and I had a blast doing that. That was unbelievable. I had a blast doing that, and then I left and went to work for a small nonprofit where I covered technology and global human resources, and wound up writing my first book, which was a textbook called A Necessary Evil, Managing Employee Activity on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and the hundreds of other social media sites. And I still hate the title. I did not give them the permission to do that, but they did it anyway. And it was a bestseller for the company. And I wound up lecturing about social media strategy all over the world, including the United States, Canada, Europe, and the Middle East and India. And I became a subject matter expert on social media strategy. Right now I'm a social media strategist for a small nonprofit in Washington, D.C. And in my spare time, I'm working my way to being a full-time novelist. I also do content creation for my church in Delaware. And I'm really happy to be here.
Great, thanks, Lynn. John?
I'm John Dedakis, from Wisconsin. Started in journalism in 1969 at the University of Wisconsin when I volunteered at a campus radio station. Got tear gassed covering an anti-war riot. That led to my first job, but it also led to the Army because my draft number was 14 during the Vietnam War. So I enlisted to avoid the draft. Got orders to Vietnam, but at the last second, almost literally the last second, the orders were changed to Germany, and I spent 2.5 years at the headquarters of the American Forces Radio and Television Network in Frankfurt, Germany, doing interviews for a special events radio unit. And the first interview my boss assigned me to do was with Alfred Hitchcock. Maybe you've heard of him. And that was a mentoring moment because my boss could have done the interview in his sleep. And he trusted this kid. So that really then made me decide to go into journalism. Got out of the Army, got a degree in broadcast journalism at the University of Wisconsin. Was a journalist for 45 years, covered the White House when Reagan was president, went to CNN in Atlanta in 88 as a writer, Probably the most significant plot twist was when they made me an editor. I had no idea what that was, but the guy who recruited me wanted off nights and weekends, and I was a warm body to replace him. So I did that, and I discovered that editing was tedious, but it paid well. So I wrote a book. I needed a creative outlet, and the novel I wrote took 10 years to get published, to find the agent that I've got. I've got 6 mystery suspense thrillers. All of them have a journalism backdrop. I write as a 20-something young woman. I'm neither. We'll talk. There's a 12-step program. And so now I'm a manuscript editor, writing coach, teacher, recovering journalist.
And I didn't hear you mention a name. You did. You were the editor, copy editor for a well-known journalist at CNN. Who was?
I was one of Wolf Blitzer's editors on the Situation Room in D.C. for 7 years.
Okay. And after hearing all this, I think you can say this is the most esteemed panel we have at this conference. I'm going to say that when I saw it, and I'm so honored to be your moderator. I'll ask the first question, and it's the title of this this breakout session: what journalists do and what they don't do. And so I'd like to ask you to think about, what is a journalist, and what is a journalist do and don't do? What are some things that you would think about? People maybe have misconceptions about journalists.
Yeah, thank you.
So what are some of the misconceptions? And I'll start at this end with John and ask, what are the misconceptions that people have about journalists? What do they believe about journalists nowadays? Because as Caitlin mentioned in her presentation this morning, the dying newspaper industry. You think journalist, oh, that's a reporter for a newspaper. Well, I don't know. So, John, you want to tackle that one?
Well, actually, the title of the panel is something I suggested, because as an editor, I'm coming across a lot of manuscripts where people have journalists as characters, often as the villain. And, we have writers' conferences where you have cops who are offering professional advice on how cops do their jobs. But what I'm discovering is, in the manuscripts I'm editing, people don't have a clue what journalists do. And some of the ways they write the news story that is part of the plot, I mean, most of these would never get into print or on the air based on the way they're written. The quick answer is, I believe, based on my experience, most people think that we sit around and go, how are we going to get Barack Obama elected? And we do not make things up. Unlike what some presidents will tell you, that is a firing offense at any reputable news organization. The problem now, and I'm sure we're going to get into this, is that anybody now with a cell phone who hits send is a publisher. But who's on your shoulder saying, where'd you get that? So we are in the Wild West now, and even CNN and some of the bigs are changing, and there are some things that anchors are saying, I never would have let on the air. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Good. Aaliyah, any comments?
John is exactly 100% right. I think there's this misconception, especially, you know, for me being an entertainment editor and watching a lot of movies, reading a lot of books, and seeing journalists portrayed as liars, as thieves, as criminals who will do anything to get a story, is something that we do not do. People think that if we're like nefarious, these dark characters who do all kinds of things just to get a story. Any of those things that people would do would either, first would get you fired and could land you in jail. And so we have ethics, at least we're supposed to. When we go to journalism school, that's the one thing they teach us, is that your integrity and your ethics are everything, because people need to believe you when you're writing something, and they can't believe you if you're lying or if you're making something up. And there have been cases where some journalists have made things up and have gotten into a lot of trouble. So we have to make sure that we're above board when we're covering the news. And I think that's a misconception, that people think that, you know, we'll do anything and we'll lie and we'll say we're, you know, someone else when we're not supposed to be, just because they want us to get a story, and they want the story to be good.
Yeah, thank you. Caitlin?
This is a question that I could answer for about 3 hours.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a hard time condensing everything I want to say. But I think what we have today is a journalism landscape unlike we've ever seen. So I think part of the problem is that we don't have good rules today in journalism, because the people who are in journalism, not everybody, but there are a lot of people who are in journalism, and there are some TV networks that I can think of that are so completely activist and so completely propaganda machines that they are giving everybody else a bad name. And I think that's part of the problem. So there's a big part of the public that doesn't understand that there are certain news stations that are not news stations. They are opinion and commentary stations based on people's opinions, not on facts. And what we've got now is this huge misinformation and disinformation network that is powered and fueled by political parties feeding them talking points that have nothing to do with what's actually happening. And I know that you guys probably have done this. You turn on one cable network and you turn on another, and you're wondering how this one over here is not covering like the biggest story, or if they are, they've got such a bizarre twist on it that you can't even believe that this is news, because it isn't news. And there's a lot of people out there that's where they're going for their information. So that's just the foundation of what's going on. When I was a journalist working at a newspaper, we did have a lot of ethical rules. And what I found was that I was one of the most ethical people on staff. And I would come and confess things and tell people, my editors, in front of everything, because I wanted it to be out on the table. And I would get in trouble for things when I was more ethical than the people who were doing things and not telling what they were doing. And somehow that ended up going against me. So I mean, I kind of use those things in my novel for my character, because, and there are people who read it go, was this you? Based on you? And I say, well, you know, based on my experiences, yeah, these things happened. Where And it's fun, it's cathartic for me to feed that into this super ethical journalist who is doing things the way they were supposed to be done. And it's set in 2015, so it's kind of historical fiction at this point, because it takes place in a newsroom, which we don't even have in San Diego anymore. The newspaper I used to work at, the San Diego Union Tribune, all the reporters work remotely at home. There is no newsroom anymore. That is so sad to me. So, I mean, I think, even though I've never met any of you before, I'm sure we all have a lot of things in our personalities that are in common, where we feel righteous about exposing wrongdoing, you know? And it's like, we are kind of activists, but we know we're not allowed to be. The problem with journalists, many journalists today, is they are activists and they are propagandists, and they think that that's right, and we know it's not. And as I said, I can keep going, but that's enough.
Do you feel better?
Fired up.
Do you feel better?
Honestly, it was great.
So how do you really feel?
I told you, I could keep going.
I'll see your 17 years and raise you 40. I started writing war stories and fairy tales literally 40 years ago. This is a true 40-year journey. I started writing it. I'm a retired Army officer. I did two combat tours during Vietnam. And I knew a lot of things, and my contemporaries, and we all sit around and tell what we call war stories. You know, it's like, oh, when I was in Vietnam, I did so. And so I started collecting these and writing them down. And I got a publisher who said, I really like them, but I had stories about the Marines. I had a story about the Air Force. I had a story about the Navy down in the Delta. And he said, I don't do short stories. So if you can figure out some way to kind of tie them all together, I might be interested. And so I agonized over it, and I came up with the idea of a war correspondent who could be at all of these places and see all of these things. And over the years, I rewrote this thing probably 20 times. And because of Army transfers and deployments, and it just kept getting pushed on back. And literally 40 years later, I pitched it to an editor at Sleuthfest in Florida for the Mystery Writers of America Florida chapter. And she said, I really like that. Can you make 3 books out of it? Oh, well, I got plenty of stories. So I have 23 books in print. This is book number 22. This is book number 23 of war stories. But what I did was, my correspondent, he went out and Vietnam was a war that you saw every night at dinner. It was on television. But you saw the helicopter crash. You saw the guys taking the wounded off the helicopter, putting them on a stretcher, and taking them away. But you never heard how those guys felt. How did the guy feel holding the stretcher, knowing his buddy was on it dying? So my guy, my correspondent, goes with these troops. He's on that helicopter when it crashes. He's on that helicopter when it gets shot down. He watches these guys take the people off the helicopter onto another one, to medevac them someplace, and then he comes back and he writes a weekly column about it. And he leaves the blood and guts and gore to the news media that shows it on television, and he writes about what those men felt as they took their buddy off the helicopter. So his is the human side of the war in Vietnam. And he's a correspondent now for a syndicate. His columns are getting bigger and bigger and more and more popular. Unfortunately, for me, the war actually ended. So the third book will be the end of the Vietnam War and the end of his story in Vietnam, and it'll be out next year. But all of the books, it's you see the action. You see the action as it actually happened, and then he goes back, and it's Dateline Saigon. You know, I was here, and I did this and this and this, and I saw this and this and this. So he reports the story as a reporter for a hometown newspaper, which is something that you wouldn't get, in all likelihood, during the Vietnam War. This is hometown news for him. So that's where this came from.
Thank you. David.
What I'll say is, and I think Caitlin was exactly right, the landscape is completely different even what it was 10 years ago. You know, there's been so many people laid off in both the television and the newspaper business that you have really citizen journalists now reporting on Facebook. I mean, there are a lot of Facebook groups for almost every neighborhood in America that you can go to and figure out why is the helicopter flying over my house at 2 in the morning, and you can find out. You know, you'll find out, you'll hear another neighbor record in the group that, they got the police have got somebody on my street. They got him in such and such's yard over here in the backyard. And then you have a lot of, you know, some former journalists that have put together fairly credible blogs that go to city council and that cover the things and the education department or the school board. And writing about things that newspapers simply don't have the staff to cover anymore. You know, very grassroots type stuff. The most popular thing right now, it was when I left, and it still is, are mugshots, frankly. A lot of police organizations now make their mugshots available publicly, and so you've got blogs out there that are scraping digitally the people who got arrested yesterday, the day before, and SEOing them so that they come up if somebody searched, you know, who got arrested or whatever. So there's a lot of grassroots stuff going on, and it's going to continue because papers, unfortunately, you know, paper I worked at in Orlando doesn't have a newsroom either. They have an office downtown that's got two offices and a tiny little conference room, and it was a top 20 newspaper for a lot of years, but they just can't afford to sustain it. The other thing is, What is scaring people from starting these little community blogs or whatever is you have to have an attorney behind you. If you're gonna go after a public official or a mayor or a senator or whatever, you just, even if you're right, even if you report only the facts, you can get accused of not reporting correctly. They can take you to court. Attorneys are expensive. Bloggers generally can't afford attorneys. Newspapers, we had some really good ones when I was there. So, you know, it's a tough environment, but it's splintered, and it's changed, and it's going to continue to change. So,
you mentioned lawsuits and getting sued. It seems like one of the strategies that people are using, or some people are using nowadays, is to sue the newspaper or the news source or whatever, and it almost doesn't matter about it ever going to court or what the facts are, but it's the lawsuit itself. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on maybe some of that, if you've seen any cases like that, or What would you advise if I wanted to do a podcast, for example? Should I be worried more about getting sued, or what's the situation here, John?
You should be worried about it. There's defamation, slander. There are protections, and there's a lot of Supreme Court rulings that protect journalists. But the point is, there can be nuisance lawsuits, and the whole strategy is to drain you financially to make the story go away. And if they've got deep pockets, you lose, not because you're wrong, but because they had the money.
We talked a little bit about Facebook. Just as a general citizen, if you post something about somebody else on Facebook and it's defamatory, they can sue you for libel because you have exposed a lie to more than one person. It doesn't happen very often. I haven't seen many of those kind of suits, but it's possible.
Any other comments?
Yeah, this book, Down to the Bone, came out in June. Like I said, it was delayed 3 times. Part of the reason it took a long time is because it had to be legally vetted. And it's a very complicated case, and there's a lot of new information that's never appeared in public before. You have to be really careful, because if it has not come out, since we don't have much news coverage anymore, and the lawyer says, well, has this been in the newspaper? Because it's not safe if it hasn't been in the newspaper. I'm like, do you realize that we don't have newspapers anymore? They're so small, they don't cover anything. Why is that a standard anymore? Because it's like, it's not logical. It's impossible. The reason I have a book is because this hasn't been out before. Isn't that the idea of a book? And to try to convince the lawyer of that was very difficult. The other thing is, when I go on podcasts and I'm interviewed about this, there's a guy in here who I've gone into in quite some detail, who in court, and I made this really clear, that in court during the trial, the defense said that he stole money. And I said that repeatedly. I made sure it was in quotes. I made sure to go in the transcripts. I made sure to quote the defense attorney of what he actually said in a public courtroom so that I could get the lawyers off my back. And when I go on a podcast, I'll say, hey, before we start recording, I don't want to talk too much about this guy because he was never even considered a suspect. So he could sue you and he could sue us, so we need to be really careful. My book has been vetted, but what I'm saying on this podcast, I want to be very careful. So we kind of don't really talk about him. You can read about him in the book, but I just don't want to talk about him because who knows what he's going to do.
Good. Any other comments? One of the news organizations uses the phrase, the most trusted name in news. How do I, as a consumer, trust somebody? What are the ways that I can use to trust a journalist or to trust a news organization?
Anybody? For me, I think it's turning to reputable news entities. I read the New York Times every day voraciously. I trust the New York Times.
But Donald Trump says it's fake news.
I know. I don't trust Donald Trump. And I'm not alone in that assessment. But I read the Washington Post. I watch CNN. And I tend not to pay attention to, and that's because of what I've done for a living and where I've worked. And for me, I'm going to only read those reputable sources because that's what I believe. And then the other things, you know, I'll look at TikToks, I look at social media, I work as a social media strategist, and I consume a lot of news, but I'm verifying a lot of what I see. So if I see things that don't actually, you know, meet the sniff test, so to speak, I'm going to actually try to do my own research and say, is that really true? Let me go to the source and see, or let me figure out if this appeared somewhere else in a reputable news.
What do you mean reputable?
For me, reputable are the standard traditional publications, like the Times. Like, if I can find out from CNN, from any place that these are sources that I trust for me, because I know that in the past, I was on staff at USA Today, so I know sometimes some of the reporters that are still there and the editors that are still there. I know how they work, how they operate. So I'm going to trust that just from my own experience as a layperson now. But, you know, for a lot of people, it's like you said, they're watching what they think is news that isn't really news. So
One thing, have you noticed though, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, I read the New York Times as well, and I thought that's the safest thing, right? But what I've also noticed since Trump was elected this time, they are so neutral to the point of normalizing crazy behavior. They're not calling it out. They're not being critical about it. Mm-hmm. They're not doing what I think a reputable newspaper should be doing. They've backed off so much. And I don't know if that's because they're going to have to pay $16 million settlements, which seems to be the magic number lately, or they don't want to get thrown out of the White House press pool. I mean, I don't even trust the Times necessarily anymore because I'm seeing this weird tone that I don't feel mm-hmm. is watchdog enough.
To be honest with you, I was shocked that the Wall Street Journal went after Donald Trump the way that it did and continues to.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Because it's like, you know, but that's the thing. It's like, wow. And even after Trump spoke to the owner, they're still doing all this stuff, you know, and it's just.
You just used an interesting phrase, went after.
Well,
the Trump people would say, aha, you guys have an agenda. And
well, but considering what they were doing before, I think that's the proper terminology because it's such a contrast, right? I mean.
I have a question.
Yeah. John, I think you said a very relevant word, too. You said, or maybe it wasn't you, owner.
Probably not.
Owner. I was wondering if you've talked about the effect of politics as a pressure that is shaping news.
Yes.
But are there other pressures, like economic pressures, corporate pressures, other things, who the publisher is, who the owner is? What do you think about that now as compared to historic?
I think also, too, we have a lot of publications that are only online, and they depend on page views for money and advertising. So they're looking at their analytics to see what stories are actually trending higher than others, and then they're funneling all those resources into those stories. So they're making their decisions about news based on whether or not they know people are going to click on the articles on their website and whether their advertisers are going to be pleased as a result of that. So that has a lot to do with it too now. Things have shifted in the ways that we consume news and the priorities for a lot of these publications, even though they shouldn't have changed. It's all about money. It's a money-making business in addition to actually what we would like to think that they're doing the right thing by reporting the news the way that they should.
I think advertising pressures have always been there.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been there in the 40s and 50s, and the smaller the community, the higher they are. Even though there are a lot of online publications and a lot of newspapers have gone 24/7 online, still doing some print. If they're doing any print, they're still making money off print. You know, I know in Florida, a lot of car dealerships still advertise in the paper. I don't know why, but they do, and there's a lot of revenue to be made.
Are they still paying those $50,000, buying those $50,000 display ads?
Real estate in Florida has always been big, but the publisher is very sensitive when you're getting ready to publish a story about a big advertiser, and there's been some examples the last few years where some things have been spiked and not made it, but those pressures have been there.
I also think that the corporations and the politics go hand in hand, and you know, San Diego, for example, there's a company, a news TV company, that bought up two stations. They merged them and they've now just bought a third one. So the individual perspectives that we used to get from different channels is going away because this one owner is buying them all up. And San Diego is not a small market. And I'm kind of not happy about this because how am I going to get real news if this ideologically conservative company that is pretty obvious in its bias, you know, in the way it covers things, is buying up everything? What's going to be less? Where am I going to find responsible, neutral news that I can believe, you know?
Yes.
I have a question about retractions. Does that get you off the hook?
Sometimes.
So you make an honest mistake, not an intentional purpose. You make an honest mistake on Tuesday night, you retract it on Wednesday morning.
You ask legally or what?
Both.
A lot of times legally.
Perception, yes. Legally, mayor.
Yeah, a lot of times that gets you off the hook. Okay. I mean, you can, it depends on what the mistake is. Depends on how vitriolic the the recipient is. Okay. Generally, that's what they, that's usually the first request from the attorney.
And retractions is actually one of the standards of ethical standards.
Right.
The Society of Professional Journalists, SPJ, mm-hmm. has a whole list of ethics, journalistic ethics. It's pretty lengthy, and some of you might be surprised that there's actually an ethical standard that journalists have to meet. And if you make a mistake, it's ethical to admit it and retract it and correct the record.
And for defamation, for someone to win a case, if you have to prove malice, or at least you used to have to, I don't know. And so now if you retract something right away, that shows I'm sorry, in essence, and so that's a remedy that people will demand. And if you don't retract it, then they can try to prove malice, but it, you know, the basic foundation is it has to be true, but it's also how you word it, and people can argue about that. So.
Question in the back.
A lot of news organizations, when there's lawsuits involved, they hide behind the level where we're just entertainment. We're not, you know, what we're saying is not necessarily factual, or maybe it's just our opinion, and we're just trying to entertain people.
That's the Sean Hannity defense.
Yes, that's right. I'm kind of curious if that's a strong defense, or are they still... I mean, it seemed to work in some
It didn't
cases.
Work. Fox had to pay almost three-quarters of $1 billion.
Yeah.
It's just that Fox didn't report the amount but once, I think.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I listened carefully, and you made a salient point about bias and prejudice in the judiciary system. So what is the group of journalists all together across America doing to resolve these bias or prejudices in this judiciary system? Is the press and journalists really focusing on how to solve these problems, especially when it comes to cases that are proven facts in mm-hmm. court, but because of deep pocket by somebody else?
You may want to restate the question.
Okay,
you know,
yeah, let me restate the question. If what as a group of journalists nationwide, what are we doing to kind of combat some of this kind of misinformation, all that kind of stuff? You mentioned the Society of is there an association that most or all journalists are part of, or are journalists? Of course, we all decide they're citizen journalists, but as a group, what are journalists doing to combat some of the things we've been talking about?
I mean, the problem partly is when you say media, that's plural. So it's not a monolith. I mean, I hate it when people say the media, as if we all have a conference call, you know, nationally in the morning to decide what's the story of the day. So the problem is it's like herding cats. Any one of us every day has had screaming arguments in our newsroom about what's the news today, what's the lead. And so, you know, to be able to correct the record nationally for all of us, it's almost futile.
Yeah, I don't think there is no way for everybody to have a common voice, because there are so many of us, but we don't, I think there's a lot of people who've been bought out and they're freelancing, or they're working for independent, you know, nonprofits, or they're, you know, there's not a single voice or a single organization for us to do that through. I don't know that, I mean, that's not a common thing for a lot of different industries either. So it's a nice idea, ideologically, but I wish we did.
Right.
So I don't think
and
that
I have
exists.
Been in the past a member of the National Association of Black Journalists, and
right.
I don't even think
right.
that they
yeah.
they don't. I don't think that they do something like that where
yeah.
they're tackling
right.
that kind of a thing
right.
at all. It's hard, you know, in this day and age, because there's so much information coming from so many different corners of the internet. You know,
right.
not just from these newspaper websites, but from all the social media sites too.
Well, and I think, you know, like the AMA, they might come together and write a letter. The medical doctors come together and they might publish something as an op-ed or whatever. I think that would be, that's a kind of a nice model for us to follow, but I don't, we just don't have that. Because we're splintered.
Right.
You know, there's so many media that are different kinds of journalists.
Right.
You know, there's, like we've been discussing, there's not, it's not the old days where we just have one type of journalist.
Yeah,
it's
and you can see it in a White House briefing. It's like scattershot. One person, you know, asks a question, Caroline Leavitt or Trump will say that's a stupid question, and you would hope that another journalist would say, well, wait a minute, what about this? And instead they're asking about, you know, did Zelensky wear a suit in the Oval Office? And, you know, so we're going off in different tangents, even with the same person at the podium.
And we have a lot of former people who were on TV who are now part of the government, who, and they're there because they were on TV, not because they're qualified to hold that position.
We have a question.
Yeah, so since we've moved away from traditional papers and reporting, and everything is online, and anybody can be a reporter without facts, where do you see the future of correct journalism, the truth, as best as you can get it, you know, from both sides, right wing, left wing, the middle, where do you see it coming and maybe coming together to get the correct information and to disqualify some of the, you know, from both sides, that really kind of screaming radical nonsense. You know, so where do you see journalists like making that big change in the future?
I think you read my notes here. This is the in the few minutes we have left. What's the future of journalism? And given all of these issues, the fracturing, the so many, anybody can be, what's the future of journalism? So I'll tell you what, we'll start down here with David, if you'd like to comment on that,
thanks.
And then we'll just come down. And we've got just a few minutes.
Answer I would invest. You know, I think we're going to see more pain before we see any pleasure. I think there's going to be more splintering. I think these organizations are going to start trim down. I mean, I know Washington Post is going to be having some more layoffs coming. You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think it's going to take a real grassroots effort from, frankly, the readers who are fed up with, you know, not seeing news that they need to make their lives better. You know, and like I say, starting in school board meetings and burning of books and those kinds of things, and the accurate coverage of local council meetings and all the stuff there, because those are the elections that really matter to people, you know, property taxes and all that stuff. You know, I think we're going to continue to see the splintering. I don't know. I mean, maybe these big private equity firms that own some of these newspaper corporations are going to have to get out of it and start selling back to the community. That's my hope.
Okay.
Not being a working journalist, I have a different perspective here on this. And I think we talked about the $50,000 car ad and the three pages of real estate ads, and a reporter who is working on a big story that could possibly earn him or her a Pulitzer Prize. All of this stuff goes together in your newspaper. The most important link in all of this, I think, is a kid who delivers your paper, because if he has a flat on his bicycle tonight, you're not going to get that paper. You're not going to see any of this. So where do you find it if it's not, where do you get a consolidated amount of all that information if it's not in your local newspaper? How many places do you have to go to see the car ads, to see the real estate ads, to see the Pulitzer Prize winning column, to see the council meeting, to see all of these other things, because kid had a flat on his bicycle. Where do you go? I don't know.
Or if they don't have internet in a rural community.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. Future of journalism.
Well, I keep saying this, I've been saying it for a while, but I keep hoping for the boomerang effect. It's just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse until finally maybe people are going to realize that, like you were saying, that, you know, they're not getting what they need, and it's going to affect them in a personal way. But unfortunately, since we have the paywall, there still are a few news organizations, but you now have to pay for them, and nobody wants to pay for journalism because for some reason they think there's not enough value in it. So it's really a matter of money. We have the wrong people buying up newspapers who are more concerned about money than they are about you know, truth. Public welfare and truth and public good and helping the community. They're not in that for, they're not buying these papers for that reason. So they come in with the wrong intention. What I think is probably gonna happen is we're just gonna have a whole bunch of little organizations that are gonna pop up everywhere to try to fill in what the community's not getting. And eventually some of them may merge, and then we may start to see, you know, a groundswell from the bottom, so that we will have more of the smaller and regional organizations popping up because we need them. And, you know, we can't have a proper democracy without them. But more than that, people just don't get the information, the basic information that they need. Parking's going up, or the trash, we're gonna start instituting trash fees, or your water fees are going up. I mean, just like the basic stuff that you need as a homeowner, there's just not really, or election information, who do I vote for? There's just not that kind of information. So I just feel like, and it's happening, you know, in small pockets and nonprofits. And I think that's gonna be happening more. And I'm hoping, like I said, the boomerang effect, will start seeing them coming back. That's what I'm hoping, that's what I'm seeing.
Good, thank you. Aline?
So about a dozen years ago, AOL founded Patch.com,
yeah,
which is a listing of community newspapers, so to speak, online. So you could go to Patch.com, type in your zip code, and read about those meetings at city councils, or whether or not the groceries are a certain price in your area, or anything that has happened in your community, arrest reports, crime logs, those kinds of things, and they're written in a news-like perspective. However, what scares me the most is artificial intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
And what we see online, we may have to question what we see and what we hear eventually. There are no guardrails right now, and sometimes you'll look at something and you'll think it's the truth and it's not. Right now, it's sort of herky-jerky. You can look at it and say, okay, that doesn't look like it's real. But what happens 6 months from now, a year from now, when you look at something and it looks like the president actually said something, or he did something, like he said he could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot someone? What if there's AI that actually promotes that and it winds up all over the place and we don't know whether it's true or not? You know, that's what scares me, because it's only going to get better. The other thing, too, is there, even before we had artificial intelligence, there were newsrooms, and there are still, that don't have newspaper reporters anymore, and they're actually using artificial intelligence to actually write news articles now, to write screenplays, to write books. You know, the Authors Guild has launched a lawsuit against the makers of ChatGPT because they're using our stories to train these large language model machines to write stuff that we write. And so what, it's scary, all of it. It's not just what's journal, you know, what journalism is gonna look like, but what's publishing gonna look like, what the film industry is gonna look like. So it's scary. And I don't know what the answer or what the solution is, but it's something we all need to be mindful of.
I would just quickly say, I'm an optimist for no apparent reason.
Okay, I want to thank our panelists. And another way to thank them is to do what I did, and that's to go buy one of their books, and I'm going to ask them to autograph that for me. So thank you, panelists, and thank you all for attending here, and we'll see you at the next session.
And I have a couple books here if anybody wants them.